You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, November 1st, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Kara is not available this week. She's actually not going to be available until we leave for Australia, New Zealand.
Busy, busy time of year for her.
Very, very busy. And we're recording. This is a rare Friday recording because Bob was not available. He had a work emergency on Wednesday, so we had to delay it until Friday.
Bob had a Halloween emergency yesterday, right, Bob?
I just want to say today's November 1st, the worst day of the effing year.
With a passion.
But Bob, wait, I had a better Halloween today than I did yesterday.
That's crazy talk.
No, it's not. Think about it. And your party is Saturday night. That's even going to be more Halloween.
That's the only reason why I'm not in a major depression right now.
But after your party, it'll be a full year till any Halloween festivities again.
Well, a little bit less than a year, but yes.
Yeah.
Should Halloween be moved to the last Saturday of each October?
The big debate. I'm totally of two minds.
It's kind of nice to have it, you know, on random nights of the week, but it would be logistically a little bit easier if it were predictably on a Saturday night.
The other thing they could do is they could couple it with daylight savings, and then that Sunday, right, you get the extra hour after you're filled up with candy and sugar.
Or they get rid of the whole changing the clock thing because it's stupid.
Well, that's true, too. But I'm saying if you had to take that into consideration, that would be perhaps a reason to want to codify it and turn it into a day of the calendar rather than a day of the week rather than the same date of the calendar.
But more importantly,
yes.
Bob, I went to see your Forest of Fear.
Yes. What'd you think,
very,
Steve?
Very good. It was excellent. I've seen all of your haunts over the years.
Yes, and even worked in some.
And even worked many of them, yep.
Bob's old haunts.
And this was a good one. This was a really, really good one. You have some very nice new props. I like the that giant floating ghostly girl puppet.
We had a lot of volunteers this year, and one volunteer is a crazy Halloween nut like me, and she donated a bunch of interesting props, and that was one of them. And it was wonderful, beautiful sculpt and paint job. But we just over 4 days, we did 2,000 people. Went to charity, local charity, and it's just so happy that it did so well. Reviews were off the hook, but the best thing, of course, was my version 4.0 zombie costume.
Mm. Yeah. what is the 4.0 here, Bob? Like, what did you do that was topped? Like, you have like a full body zombie costume where it really does look like bones are sticking out of it and everything. But what's better than last year?
Well, I mean, over the years of the haunts that I've done, the professional haunts, I've gone from just a mask and a messed up jacket, to a mask with a full chest piece, and then to another mask and a really, really good suit for the zombie. This one is the best one because it's a neck to ankle to wrist amazing bodysuit that's just like bones and dark places all over my body. And then over that, I hot glued creepy cloth, which is like a cheesecloth, and then added bugs and I used the same awesome skeleton mask throughout all of these, or most of them, and it's just the combination. It's really a movie quality thing that I have here. It's so good that I'm having a hard time imagining improving it, for that type of super skeletal type of zombie, which is like one of my favorite classes of zombies. So yeah.
What is it with Halloween? Like, why do you love it so much?
Oh boy, Jay. Yeah, it's almost, it's ineffable. I mean, it's the feeling, that macabre feeling and the colors and the textures and the emotions that it brings out in me. It's just really hard to quantify. But I felt this way since I was a kid. Yeah. Since a little kid, I always had to be a monster. So this creepy idea, this aesthetic, I just fell in love with it at a very early age, and I just can't shake it, and I don't want to shake it, and just something that's, I don't know. Steve, what do you think? What would cause that? Because we all appreciate it, except maybe our sister, but we all appreciate the macabre and creepy things, but I just took it to the highest levels of any of us, but it's just hard.
Yeah, who knows how much of it is hardwired, how much of it is learned behavior. Yeah. I mean, we all think it's cool, but you definitely have an extra fascination for it. What's interesting, so this is the comment I made to Bob at the end of the haunt. So we've been to professional haunts, not only Bob's, but ones in the area that are like the high end, really high end. You pay a lot of money to a professional haunt. Yeah. And one thing there's one thing that every single haunt that I've been to has in common, and that is terrible acting. I haven't been to a single haunt where the actors had any clue what they were doing.
These aren't LARPers, I suppose.
That's right. And I think it's partly I'm spoiled by my LARPing experience, right? Because even though, you know, not that acting and LARPing is great, but it's, you know, it's an order of magnitude better than what you get out of the newbies who are running these haunts. Yep. Like, I'm like, I couldn't help going, like, the scenery, the props, everything was great. And I couldn't help critiquing the performance of every single actor along the way because they were just terrible.
It's very common. I've only really been to a couple of haunted houses where they really take the acting seriously. For the most part, it's really like teenagers that are just basically out for a startle scare, which is like the lowest level scare.
Yeah,
it's the lowest level scare that exists. There's a continuum from the startle scare, which anyone can do, all the way up to terror, sheer terror, which is really hard to evoke in somebody and to cause it, to have an actor actually produce that in somebody. And that's rare, but you don't have to reach those heights. But the startle scare is so annoying. You know, once in a while, sure, but the haunt should not be 95% startles. And that's what you see because it's, you know, it's cheap. You pay the actor a little. I mean, I had professional actors at my haunt in 10 years ago, and Jay's wife was one of them, and a few of her acting friends, and it just like opened my eyes to have a real actor, somebody who really could act and become a character in my haunt was, you know, put it into such sharp contrast to the usual teenagers that I was hiring. Yeah. And it was just like, oh my God, this is what it
could be like.
It makes you
feel like you're participating more in the event itself if they can bring you in on that acting level. That's a huge difference.
You could bring a creep level. Like, you could do something really, really creepy. That's the best haunts are ones that like give you chills, not necessarily terror. But it's like they really, they draw you into some kind of scenario. And it's the combination of what you're looking at and what's happening. And then there's some story, even though it's a very quick story, that you can, you know, convey along the way. Like, there were, like, at one point in your haunt, Bob, there was a girl in a really good ghost costume. She had a very good, creepy, flowing ghost costume. She was haunting some section of your thing. And she said nothing. Like, there was no story, no acting, nothing. Like, why? You're just standing there kind of moving a little bit, you know? But I get it. I know you're dealing with, what you can get. But that was a golden opportunity. Like, you know, have you ever seen a horror movie? Like, you saw The Shining, the two creepy girls, come and play with us. Give me a line. Give me something, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You have to have a hook. Yeah. You have to feel like, even though you know, you're in this preposterous collection of rooms and, you know, this hallway and stupid lights. Yeah. Like,
there's a story. There's got to be a story there.
Exactly. It's the best haunts are the ones that have some type of story flowing through them. And also, like, you walk into a room and you don't want to just see someone stand there and, like, look at you as you walk by. You want them to be, like, pleading with you or, you know, like, whatever. Like, the things that creep me out the most are definitely when there's something much more sinister going on one level deeper.
Yeah.
Like, that's why The Evil Dead, as funny as The Evil Dead series is, especially, it gets more funny as they go. The first one, I don't know. They did want it to get, I guess it was deliberately hokey and everything. But my God, the story is so good. The background story is so good. And the demon possessions are so intense, right?
Like, yeah.
Like, you really believe in those moments when you watch that movie, those people are possessed, you know? Like, it just creeps under your skin. And I love that. I totally agree with you, Steve.
Yeah. And I'm watching. I just recently discovered season 3 of Ash versus the Evil Dead, and that has a great combination, a good balance of a lot of humor and over the top. Like, I've seen a lot of gore, and I've seen gore in this series that I'm like, oh my God, what did I just watch? I've never seen that, and I will never see it again. And I can't describe it on the show because Steve would edit it out. And it was just amazing gore and humor.
Yeah. You love that combination, how about?
It's tough to pull off.
All right, we got some interesting news items for you, Jay. You're going to start us off with an update on Elon Musk's Starship.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people that are, you know, not big fans of Elon. I get it. You know, I understand. There is definitely a love him or hate him type of thing going on out there. But we have to just admit that he is a fantastic innovator, and he really does want to push the industries that he's operating in as far as they can go. It's the way it seems. I mean, he's turning the industries that he's involved in up on their heads and starting like with a massive amount of technology, you know, the driverless cars.
Is he our generation's Howard Hughes, would you say?
Yeah, he's a Howard Hughes.
He's eccentric in his own way and all the other things, but he's just pouring so much money and trying so many different things. You got to give him credit.
And he's more successful than the Spruce Goose, that's for sure.
Guys, it did fly though.
Guys, Tesla was profitable for the first time this quarter.
Cool. Yeah.
And now we're moving into space flight. And Musk is doing everything that he can to make his company, SpaceX, provide affordable flight. You know, that's why he developed the retro rockets, as an example. We want the world to be able to achieve space flight without it having to be run by governments or just the absolute top, you know, richest companies in the world. When you look at who is developing space flight today, we got Virgin Galactic, we have Amazon with their
Bezos, yeah.
Blue yeah, right. Horizon. Blue Horizon, and then you got
Blue Origin
and SpaceX. You know, not many companies are doing this. You know, we do have a handful of governments that are sending moon missions more now than ever, or at least space missions, which is good. We have India, we got China. Now, we've seen fantastic success with SpaceX. I mean, his technology is working. There was a statement that SpaceX put out recently, and I'm going to read this to you real quick. Aspirationally, we want to get Starship, which is the name of their ship, to orbit within a year. We definitely want to land it on the moon before 2022. We want to stage cargo there to make sure that there are resources for the folks that ultimately land on the moon by 2024 if things go well. So that's the aspirational time frame. Now, that's man, that is such a cool thing. Again, so especially with this, the success of the renewable rockets, we also have the Falcon 9 rocket and its successor, the Heavy Falcon rocket or Falcon Heavy rocket. And they both have also proven to be operationally sound, that, you know, successful missions, reusable components. You know, they're testing the Dragon capsule. Now the Dragon capsule has been to the International Space Station. It brought cargo there. It brought stuff back from the station. You know, we're very, very soon going to see people traveling on the Dragon capsule. They have the first crewed mission scheduled in 2020, and it marks the beginning of the private corporations beginning to move into the space sector. This is it. This is formally going to take place very soon to a space, you know, space above your head near you. So SpaceX has their first crewed mission scheduled for 2020, which is within the next 6 months or so, and it marks the beginning of private corporations transporting people into space.
Yes, yeah, so that's the Falcon Heavy with the Dragon capsule. Yeah, so I was trying to wrap my head around, like, what is the suite of ships that SpaceX has now? So they got the Falcon 9, which is a light rocket for getting basically just satellites into orbit. The Falcon Heavy, which can get more payload, including the Dragon capsule, which could be crewed or uncrewed. And now they're moving into the Starship, which is for deep space, not for orbit.
And is that the one that has a more lifting capacity than Saturn V?
Yes, than anything ever. Yeah.
How have the tests gone so far
about
on that?
Time.
They haven't built one yet.
Well, they're in motion here, Steve.
Yeah, they're building it, but they haven't completed one. They haven't tested one yet. So that's a lot to do by 2022. They want to get one all the way to the moon by 2022.
Now, let's start with this by saying that it looks like a science fiction rocket, which is...
Oh, my God. So beautiful.
It's so cool that from a technology perspective, SpaceX decided that they're going to build the, I said where, you know, but they're going to build it out of steel or, you know, steel alloy.
Apparently it's going to be 301 stainless steel.
Yeah.
Which is odd, you know, when I eventually discovered that, because stainless steel isn't the strongest steel, but apparently it has good features in cryogenic temperatures, right? The low temperatures of space. So I didn't know how, like, when the reports were saying stainless steel, like, is it really going to be stainless steel or is it going to be some other alloy of steel? But apparently it really is going to be stainless steel.
Like the same stainless steel we see in our kitchens?
But, well, there's 150 different kinds of stainless steel.
Okay.
This is 301 stainless steel, which is 16 to 18% chromium by weight. So that has very specific properties, you know.
But it has better properties in a lot of regards, except for weight, than, you know, the composites that they could
use. Yeah, the carbon.
You would think, though, that weight would be paramount.
Well, Bob, two-thirds of this ship is fuel storage.
Gee whiz.
It's an engine. Guys, this is the thing that it's very easy when you look at a rocket, especially when I was younger, you know, you look at a rocket and you just imagine like there's all sorts of corridors and things. No, it's like people are sitting on top of a bomb.
Controlled explosion.
Cylinder of fuel. Yeah.
Yeah. And Rusty Swikert said it. So I got to go back to this magical episode we had with Rusty Swikert. He's saying like that ship, when that rocket engine takes off and you start moving, you get squeezed into the seat. And then when those engines turned off, he said they're strapped in super tight. He still got launched forward in from his seat, like with his head, like, you know, the way he described it, I kind of remember him saying something like, you know, it's like almost his head hit the dashboard, you know?
Because he had loosened his belt. He loosened his harness because it was too tight. And then so the whole ship got compressed like a spring. And when the engine went off, it extended like a spring. And it launched him, and his face came within 2 inches of the board.
Good, I didn't make that up.
Oh, yeah. No, he said, oh, boy, I better tell the next guys about this. Like, don't loosen your harness. You really got to keep that thing tight. They just didn't think about the whole spring aspect of what that would mean. And stainless steel, it's going to be the same thing with the Starship.
Yeah, and you want the material just like a bridge with concrete. You know, they flex. They move. Yeah. They twist. You need the ships to behave that way.
That's the steel. That's the rebar that is flexible. Yeah.
To put a nice little bow on this, it's a very exciting time to be a fan of space travel and also to love like that 50s science fiction aesthetic.
The rocket is beautiful. So it's two stages, we should mention. You have the rocket portion of it. The booster is called.
Steve, that's called the Super Heavy Rocket.
Yeah, that's right. The Super Heavy. So just two stages. The Super Heavy Rocket will lift it off into orbit, and then that would be reusable. That will land vertically. And then the Starship is 2/3 fuel and 1/3 passengers / cargo, and that's a deep space ship. What's neat about that is like this ship, which itself looks like a rocket, you know?
Yeah.
The whole thing will land on the moon or will land on Mars and then take off again.
So cool.
So there's no descent ship or anything else like with the Apollo missions. That's it. It's just two stages total because they want the whole thing to be reusable.
It's
amazing to think that Musk wants to send that ship to Mars, land on Mars, and then come all the way back.
Talk about ambition. I mean, whoa.
I mean, this is the kind of ship that had like flames coming out the back on in the movies in the 40s and 50s, like where the flames actually are going up because of the, you know, when they shoot it. Like, you could tell like which way gravity is and the flames are going up, you know, off the camera. Like it's cheesy, right? That's the ship. That's what he just built. And this thing is going to land and have landing gear and take off and land on another planet and take off.
I know. When this thing lands on the moon, that is right out of a 1950s science fiction movie.
Totally.
It's perfect. And it's going to be stainless steel on one side, and the other side is going to be coated with glass tiles for reentry.
It's kind of a vindication to those science fiction authors of the early and mid-20th century.
Who would have thunk it, you know, that we would be back to a vision, you know, in the post-Apollo era, we're actually going to be doing – creating something that looks even more like a 1950s spaceship. It's amazing.
I'm all for it.
It is beautiful, though.
Retro.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Bob, I understand astronomers have discovered potentially a new kind of black hole.
Yes. Astronomers have used a new technique in multiple different data sets to find what appears to be a new class of black holes smaller than they found before and filling a notorious black hole mass gap.
So a black hole, black hole?
We cannot have a
black hole. This was recently published in the journal Science. So what is this mass gap? Trying to think of an analogy. So it's like when Jay's wife cooks meatballs. She takes the pot off the stove, and then when she lifts it again, there's a mass gap because Jay ate a bunch of meatballs when she wasn't looking. So this is like that, but totally different. So low-mass black holes have a completely different type of missing mass problem. Now, I'm not talking about supermassive, or some people would call them ultramassive black holes. They get most of the press, and deservedly so. They've got millions to billions of times the mass of the sun, and they are truly the monsters of the universe. Oh, can you imagine a 40 billion? They've directly detected 40 billion mass black holes, and some indirect measurements have them much even higher than that, in the hundreds, if it's to be believed. No, I'm talking about the other end of the spectrum. And you may be thinking, oh, Bob, you must be talking about primordial black holes with their fractional solar masses. No. No, I'm not. Those are still theoretical. I think they probably exist, but it's not been confirmed that they exist. Those were created at the beginning of the universe, and the remnants, the ones that are still around, would be, you know, fractions of a solar mass. So I'm referring to black holes with a single to double-digit solar masses. And we've seen a lot of these, but 5 to 15 times the mass of the sun. Lots of them. And then – famously, in 2017, LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, detected black holes colliding, and they were 31 times the mass of the sun. Yeah, another one was 25 times. So they clearly exist in that regime of mass as well. But what about the lowest mass black holes? Where are they? We have not found them. So now we know that neutron stars would have to collapse into a black hole once they have a mass that exceeds something like, say, 2.5 times the mass of the sun. We're not exactly sure. Some calculations put it as low as 1.5, which is way too low. And all the way up to 3. So we're not sure, because these dense conglomerations of matter, these neutron stars, are so dense. It's very complex, and we're really not sure exactly where a neutron star would overcome neutron degeneracy and collapse into a black hole. But it's, say, around 2.5 times. So where are all the black holes with masses around 3 to 5 solar masses? That's the mass gap I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. I see.
They should be out there. But we haven't found them.
We have detected zero of those.
Right. So this new class of black holes, to see if this type of black hole, this new type of black hole exists, astronomers scoured through databases of information. For example, from the main one was Apogee, which is an acronym for Apache Point Observatory Galactic Evolution Experiment. So here they looked at the spectra from stars that shifted specifically from blue to red and back again, back and forth. And that would indicate that the star is being tugged by some invisible but super dense companion, probably a black hole. So what they did was, looking through this data, they found a giant red star that appeared to orbit something small and dense, but bigger than known neutron stars. So this was a decent candidate. So they did even more calculations, and they worked with other study data beyond Apogee. And, so what they concluded was that this little black hole contains about 3.3 solar masses. And that's exactly right in the sweet spot of what they were looking for. So Todd Thompson, professor of astronomy at Ohio State University, said, what we've done here is come up with a new way to search for black holes, but we've also potentially identified one of the first of a new class of low mass black holes that astronomers hadn't previously known about. So this could be a milestone that they talk about for years, because no one has really discovered black holes within this mass range. And, you know, this is still a little preliminary. It's not absolutely certain yet, so it's definitely needs to be vetted. But it would be a great advance if we did, to have this new class and new method of finding black holes that we haven't accounted for in all of our theory, you know, in all the evolution and theories of the universe. So these could factor in an important way. And what's really funny, I'll end it with this. It's what's really funny is that some astronomers are hoping that this is not a black hole. They're hoping that this is a neutron star, because if we did find a neutron star that was over 3 solar masses, like 3.5, that would be something, because all of our theories saying that after 3 solar masses, it should definitely be a black hole. So if we've got a neutron star out there that's over that 3.3, then that would be something. But, you know, chances are that this is definitely just a low mass black hole that has not been discovered before. And that will be a fantastic result as well. So we'll see what happens if they can come to something that's more conclusive.
Yeah.
Did they talk about how they'll go about confirming this?
I think other scientists going through and vetting the what they did and confirming, making sure they crossed all their T's and dotted all their I's. And maybe they can come up with an independent way, now that they know that this specific red giant has this companion. They could come up with other ways to identify its mass and to confirm it. And if they come up with 3.3 as well, then that would be, you know, much more solid.
So, Bob, is it the previously haven't discovered a black hole in this zone because they're just hard to detect, or there's just not many of them?
Right, right. I think it's hard to detect. Typically, you'll see astronomers detecting black holes if they're really far away. They could use gravitational waves, LIGO to detect them. Mm-hmm. Or if they're really close, and if it's like an active nucleus, they could look at the X-rays that the accretion disk are putting out. But these little guys, you know, they're not feeding. They're just in orbit around another star. This is really the main way to detect something like that is detecting a star that has an anomalous spectra and then calculating what the mass must be for the star to behave that way. So,
all right. Thanks, Bob. So I'm going to talk my segment. I'm calling A Tale of Two Studies.
Okay. Was it the best of times and the worst of times?
It was. So one study about organic farming, the other one about golden rice.
Gather round, children.
Gather round, children. So first, the organic study. So a group of researchers did a study where they said, what would be the impact, what would happen if the UK, the entire UK, England and Wales, switched entirely, like I said, this just says England and Wales. If that switched entirely to organic farming, what would the net effect be? And they found that there would be a 20% increase in greenhouse gas emissions if they did that. So there would be a small decrease in direct greenhouse gas production, but there would also be a 40% decrease in crop production. And if you had to replace that 40% of food, would mean, you have to buy the food from Europe or from elsewhere. And if you calculate the effect of that, it results in a net increase of emissions.
Oh, so that's worse. I see.
Yeah, this is not the only study to show this. This is now part of a growing consensus of studies basically concluding that organic farming doesn't scale, right? As you try to scale it up, it gets worse and worse, in fact, for multiple reasons. But the bottom line is that the lack of productivity is a deal killer for any kind of major rollout of organic farming. For a couple of reasons. So one is that, as we've discussed before on the show, we're basically using all of the good arable land, right? So farming takes up about 13% of all the land on Earth. And that's all the good arable land. If the further we extend increase farmland now, we have to cut down rainforests or we have to go to lower and lower quality and therefore less and less productive.
Lower yields too, I would think.
Yeah, less productive, lower yields. So it's going to be even less and less efficient. The other thing is, and we also have talked about this before, is the nitrogen cycle, right? Right now, when we're talking about producing food, we have to know where all the nitrogen is coming from for any amount of food that we produce. The Green Revolution basically occurred when we figured out that we could make artificial fertilizer, basically an artificial nitrogen source to feed into our agricultural system. Once you do that, it puts farming on steroids, right? Now, organic farming doesn't use artificial fertilizer. So they use two basic methods to get nitrogen into their crops. One is manure. There's only a certain amount of manure in the world, right? That doesn't, you can't just invent.
Well, I don't know,
more
Steve.
And more and more every day, right?
Yeah. I know a lot of people who are full of shit. Maybe they can help.
All right, get it out. Get it all out. Yeah. The other way is to plant cover crops that fix their own nitrogen, then plow them under. Right? So, but that, whenever you do that, that's a field that's not producing crops. It's just producing nitrogen for
and
the
it
next
takes energy crops. To do that process as well.
Yeah, but it also reduces the productivity to the net productivity of the land, right? Because you're using it part of the time, it's out of the loop. It's not being productive. It's just being recuperating and getting more nitrogen into the soil. These problems get worse as you try to scale up, organic farming. Organic farming is easier when it's 1%, 2% boutique farming that you can charge extra money for, But if you try to feed the world with organic, it ain't going to work. Simply isn't going to work. And it's actually worse for the environment. It will increase greenhouse gas emissions. It will worsen land use problems. It will displace more natural ecosystems. So the organic proponents, of course, they don't like numbers and reality because it gets in the way of promoting their ideology, which is this appeal to nature fallacy-based farming, right? Mm-hmm. This is what the critics are saying about it. The organic proponent critics, see if you could name this logical fallacy, right? So they say, well, this study isn't good because it assumes that we're otherwise going to be doing everything else the same and just switching from conventional to organic farming. But if we did that, if we did go to an all-natural farming system, we would also eliminate all meat. So everyone would become a vegetarian, maybe even a vegan. And we would reduce food wastage by 50%. And then we get back to even, right? That would take care of that, you know, 40% inefficiency in organic farming.
The being wrong fallacy.
Yeah. So, well, what's wrong though? So it's not wrong that if we eliminated meat production and reduced food waste by 50%, that would offset the inefficiency of organic farming. Part of the problem is that it's irrelevant. You know what I mean? It's like you could say that about anything that's disadvantageous. Say, well, if we compare it with this other unrelated advantageous thing, it would neutralize the disadvantage. It's like, okay, but we're trying to pick the best option. Why would we go with a worse option and then balance it by improvements that are unrelated, that are independent variables, right? It's like, you know, smoking is bad for the health. Yeah, but I'm going to exercise. It's like, okay, well, you should exercise anyway, but it doesn't take away from the fact that smoking is bad for your health. You'll live longer if you don't smoke, you know, whether or not you exercise, but sure, go ahead and exercise. So it's the same exact thing. It's like, yeah, well, yes, we should reduce food wastage. You're absolutely correct. Now go ahead and wave your magic wand and right. magically reduce food wastage by 50%. We'll wait. Go ahead.
Yeah. Get the whole population of the earth to comply.
Yeah.
and let's see what happens.
Yeah, get everyone to convert to veganism, and then, you know, we'll see where we are. But he said, here's the thing, even if you did do that, you would still be better off reducing our land use by 40% than going to organic farming. It's still not a good idea,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not inherently better for the environment. It's inherently worse as an independent variable. And it's just insane to talk about, but we're going to reduce food wastage. Well, okay, that's irrelevant. Go ahead, reduce food wastage. Also, they talk about it like, you know, you could just do it. You could just reduce food. So yes, there are some systemic changes that we could make to reduce some inefficiencies in the system. But, you know, food spoils. People don't buy food that doesn't look good, that is partly spoiled or whatever. There's, you know, people throw stuff out that they don't eat, and there's laws about protecting people from food poisoning and whatever. Mm-hmm. So we should think carefully about maybe how we could eke some more efficiency out of the calories that are produced in the field, so more of them get into people, you know, or are actually used. But this idea that, yeah, we'll just reduce food wastage by 50% as if that's an easy thing to do is just nonsense. If it were so easy, just go ahead and do it.
So the whole thing's a non sequitur?
Yeah, it's a non sequitur. It is absolutely a non sequitur. And it's just a distraction from the real point, which is that organic farming is not good for the environment. It's bad mm-hmm. for the environment because it, by definition, requires more land usage. If we wanted to really minimize our impact on the earth, we would reduce, I don't think we have to eliminate, but we reduce the amount of meat that we're eating. We would reduce food waste, and we would farm in the most efficient, productive, humane way possible, sustainable way possible. And that is not organic farming. That's using some of the things that organic farming does, but some of the things that they don't do or that they even oppose. Like they oppose irradiation of food, which you know what? That's a great way to reduce food spoilage and reduce food waste. So they are taking options off the table that would actually accomplish the goals they say they want to accomplish. One of which is
people. Very inconsistent of them.
One of which is genetically modified organisms, GMOs, which leads us to study number two, or the golden rice one. So one GMOs, we could make GMO wheat, for example. We're working on this. Who knows how long it will take and if it will be successful. But like, for example, with genetic modification, there's the potential to increase the efficiency of photosynthesis, improving the yield of each acre of land.
Improving it by genetic manipulation, by selective breeding, by what?
Genetic manipulation. You're never going to be able to do this with breeding. So some plants actually have a different type of photosynthesis that's more efficient than the one that most of our crops use.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. We're trying to get the efficient one into the crop plants. You can't do it with breeding or whatever. So it would take genetic modification, but it's hard. There's like a dozen different genes involved. It's not easy. It's a long project. Or you could genetically modify plants so that they could fix their own nitrogen from the atmosphere. Bing! There you go. You want to get rid of nitrogen runoff and artificial fertilizer? Let's do that. But you got to take your pick, right? You need GMOs or you can need nitrogen fertilizer. Take your pick. There was also a study out recently. I just thought these are both agricultural, so I'll just talk about them both really quickly, about golden rice. And this one's a little bit trickier, I will grant you. But it's actually, there's a book by Ed Regis that is built upon this information. And Regis argues that ideological opposition to the rollout of golden rice over the last 20 years has slowed the release of this potentially life-saving superfood to the point that it has cost millions of lives. Jeez. Millions of lives have been cost because of this.
Body count associated with this, my guess.
Yeah. So an estimated 250,000 to 500,000 children become blind every year from vitamin A deficiency, and then half of them will die over the next 12 months. Golden rice is rice that's been enriched with beta carotene, which is a precursor to vitamin A. Opposition, you know, Greenpeace is like, they're all against this. They are completely against it. Why? Because it's GMO, and that's it. It's being produced by a humanitarian effort. There's no marketing. There's no money. There's no patents. There's no big corporations. It's purely for charity. They're going to give the seeds free to farmers. It's aimed at the poorest populations in the world. It's just trying to reduce their death and suffering. And their opposition to it is basically, well, it's not perfect. Nirvana fallacy. Of course, yep. It's not perfect. And there are other options. Yes, of course, there are other options. We are pursuing those other options. We're doing them. They're not enough. Right? They're like, oh, let them eat carrots. Okay. If they could just grow freaking carrots in the desert in Africa, you don't think they would be doing that? We already have an infrastructure of rice, which is the main source of calories to the parts of the world that have vitamin A deficiency. And if that rice suddenly were fortified with an amount of vitamin A, now it's not enough to eliminate vitamin A deficiency, but it's enough to mitigate it significantly. You know, you make it part of this program, you know, where, yeah, sure, grow some other vegetables and give out supplements and let them eat golden rice. Do all of those things. Yeah, but they're like, yeah, let them eat kale. They can't just run down to superfood, you know, to Whole Foods and buy kale, right? That's not, if that were the case, that we wouldn't have 500,000 kids going blind every year from vitamin A deficiency. And then they distort the science, you know, they cherry pick to try to make it seem as bad as possible. It's fine. It works. It's been tested. Yes, of course it's not perfect, but the evidence shows it would totally work. It would save millions of lives and of kids going blind, you know, over a decade. And the money's already been spent. It was all from charity anyway. They said we should have spent that money fixing poverty. All right, good luck with that. You go ahead and fix poverty. Go right ahead. We'll wait while you're fixing poverty. We're gonna prevent some poor kids from going blind. Is that
another magic wand, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. They said this doesn't fix the underlying problem. Of course, it doesn't fix the underlying problem. It's not meant to fix the underlying problem. It's meant to mitigate some of the bad stuff that is happening as a result of the underlying problem.
Well, they're just grasping at straws. They're looking for excuses.
It's like the anti-vaxxers, like anything. Like they start with their conclusion, they are anti-GMO, and they backfill any argument they can. The logic doesn't have to be consistent. It could be a blatant logical fallacy. They cherry pick if they have to. It doesn't make sense. So again, the other thing is there's been a dozen other crops that have been genetically modified to be fortified with beta carotene. And they oppose all of them too.
What is the baseline situation here? Like, why is that?
Because they don't want a win for genetically modified organisms. But see, then they accuse the biotechnologists saying, you just want a win that you can use to market other GMOs. Like, ooh, how horrible would that be, right? The horror that we save blind kids and we could use that for propaganda purposes. That's what you're worried about, that we're going to save some blind kids? And that might put a sheen on GMOs, right? That's what they're worried about.
Defies all logic.
I think it does. But, you know, you can't argue with them. They're dead set against it.
Yeah. I've experienced people that you can't argue against. And you can't argue against them. Right?
Well, it becomes their belief system. We know exactly what happens when people embrace these things to that level. They'll clutch onto it till they die.
And then we are definitely in this phase, and we're not going to get into a big political discussion, but I've definitely noticed this. Maybe it was always there, and I'm just noticing it more now. Is people projecting, meaning that whatever they're doing, they just turn around and say, well, you're doing that. You're cherry picking. Wow. You're ideological. Nothing would convince you. It's like,
what
about
it?
It's partly whataboutism. It's partly just I'm rubber and you're glue. Whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you, right? They just turn whatever you say about them without doing an analysis, without looking at the logic, without seeing what actually makes sense. They're just saying, oh yeah, well you're illogical. You know, it's basically,
oh yeah, the oh yeah fallacy.
Yeah, it's the oh yeah fallacy.
Steve, can we formally make the oh yeah thing from the SGU? can we please make that a fallacy? Oh yeah. we've been doing this for 14 years. I think I've earned enough street cred here to have my own logical fallacy.
We'll just call it the novella fallacy. Oh, yeah.
No one else is using it. Grab it.
Yeah.
All right, Evan. So I hear that craniometry is making a comeback?
Well, that's what the headline reads. In fact, it reads exactly, "The dangerous junk science of craniometry is making a comeback." I read this item at a news site called NewStatesman.com, and it was written by Hetty O'Brien.
Hetty,
H-E-T-T-I-E. But, okay, why is it considered to be making a comeback? Well, so this is because craniometry was long ago debunked as pseudoscience, and for the most part abandoned by the middle of the 20th century. Some of the last holdouts of the practice of craniometry were in Nazi-era Germany. So they were the last holdouts in a certain sense. But here's the quick background on what it is. It's the study of the shape and form of the human head or skull. Mm-hmm. Craniometrists would take precise measurements using landmarks on the skull. And these landmarks were mainly where the bone plates in the skull meet. Those are the landmarks. The idea behind it is that you would compare one skull with another, and then make statistical comparisons between populations. The underlying assumption of craniometry is that skull size and shape determine brain size, which determines such things as intelligence and capacity for moral behavior. If you can't tell by now, this feeds right into racism, not to mention the logical fallacy of division, which states that what is true for a whole group must also be true for parts or members of the group.
It basically is racism. I mean, let's yeah. face it. I mean, it came out of that philosophy, that that ideology, and was used to reinforce it as well. And it may sound like phrenology, but it's not quite phrenology. It's not.
Yeah.
The phrenology was the idea that if you use part of your brain, that part of the brain will hypertrophy. It will get bigger, and you could the bump of the skull over it will get bigger, and you could read the bump. So that's not what this is. This is no. that, like, you have a low brow ridge. That's a sign of genetic inferiority. It's more that.
It gained legitimacy because it was championed by a physician in Philadelphia. His name was Samuel Morton. This is in the early 1800s.
Morton.
But he had an impressive collection of human skulls, and he compared them to try to confirm differences of brain sizes between the races. He collected skulls from all over the world, and he came up with a hierarchy, or basically a chart, in which the highest brain capacities were in, where else, Europeans, then Chinese, then Southeast Asians, American Indians followed, but the lower rungs of his chart were Africans and Australian Aborigines. And he was able to use his influence as a scientist and a physician to make his case for black inferiority. His work was hopelessly compromised by his own racial biases, as well as selection bias, among many other things. So it's being re-raised as a concern now in 2019 due to modern facial recognition technology, and that's the focus of this particular article. So facial recognition technology, it's becoming more and more used. It's being used by law enforcement, security firms, airlines utilize them, sports arenas utilize them, along with other places we are frequenting. And as Hetty O'Brien brings to our attention, the data sets upon which algorithms are trained to have been found to contain biases, really bad biases. For example, some of these AI systems have error rates of no more than 1% for lighter-skinned men, and the same systems will have an error rate of up to 35% for darker-skinned women. So there's too much imperfection going on here, clearly, and there are some gaps, there are some problems. So they So computer scientists are trying to make the data more diverse, but it creates its own problems. For example, IBM researchers believe they found a way to mitigate certain problems. And in a paper that they published earlier this year, an article, I should say, they noted that certain classifications such as gender, age, skin color, these are insufficient measurements when trying to get fair and accurate assessments for their facial recognition technology. So some of the researchers have suggested that using craniofacial distances, areas, and ratios, that's an exact quote, basically facial symmetry and skull shapes, will help them categorize faces within the training data. They're trying to get more granular, in a sense, trying to come up with more fine ways of refining it so that their technology will come up with less off results. But it's essentially a modern take on craniometry. It's repackaged and repurposed for this. Now, IBM, I wouldn't accuse IBM of trying to make intelligence assessments of people using this technology or trying to determine, say, what the potential criminal behavior is based on the size of a person's skull. But to reconstitute this practice has a bad history, a really tainted history with all the bigotry and flawed concepts that go hand in hand with it. And there are people who are speaking out against it. In the article, they got a quote from Kate Crawford, who is a research professor at New York University, co-founder of the AI Now Institute. And she says, the IBM team asked whether age, gender, and skin color were truly sufficient to generate a diverse data set, and they concluded to have even more vectors of diversity, they would move into this truly strange territory of facial symmetry and skull shapes. In some ways, this is reinscribing the old biology is destiny belief, and particularly a kind of biological determinism in relation to race, which societal scientists have profoundly critiqued over 50 years, if not longer. So, what do you think about companies like IBM trying to bring this level of trying to gather data into their work?
Yeah, it seems like they're kind of looking where the light is good.
Sure.
You know, they're doing this because the technology allows them to do it, not because it's backed by solid science. But a lot of it depends on how they're going to use it, right? So if they're just using this to improve the accuracy of their facial recognition system or a categorization system, that's fine. But I think the inherent problem that people are pointing to, that scientists are pointing to, is they're drilling down to smaller and smaller details with the assumption that those tiny details of facial symmetries and proportions, etc., are determined by some strict categories of race, rather than you're getting too deep now into individual variation. And the individual variation, as we've discussed on the show before, is actually far greater than any social or racial categorization. And so they're inadvertently wading into the pseudoscience here, which unfortunately has a bad history of supporting racism. So I think they just need to tread very, very carefully. And there is at least, you know, one company that, or some companies are starting to use this for things like job applications. They're actually going to recommend whether or not you should be hired based upon your facial features and comparing them to the facial features of previous hires and whether or not they were deemed to be successful. That is pure pseudoscience. That is, I think, where the real danger area is here. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. Okay, this is a once in a pretty much since I have been doing Who's That Noisy situation. So many people guessed correctly that there was only one guess that was incorrect out of all the emails I got.
What was the one incorrect guess?
The one incorrect guess was from iPuppy, who's been writing in quite a bit. And he said, Jay, my totally baffled guess for this week, some sort of sound made by a metal plate being hit or rubbed by something on its edge, like a violin bow. First, two strokes. Second sound, two short strokes. Since I know this is wrong, I am eager to find out what the right answer is. Hope you have a great Halloween. Regards, Brian, iPuppy, Tetrault. So, okay, that was a cool guess. But don't feel bad, because apparently everybody saw wherever this sound came from. It came from some podcast originally, but it is, you know, a recent recording that was made. It's probably all been over the news and everything, so everybody and their grandmother knew what this one was. So I'm going to go right to the winner, because I don't have anything else to tell you guys, unless you want to make a bad guess.
Yeah, go ahead.
Nope.
Wesley Otwell wrote in, he said, Shizow, S-C-I-S-H-O-W, Shizow. I guess it's the name of the show. Just released a video about this bird, Steve. It's a bird.
Okay.
It's the Amazon white bellbird.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Procneus albus. And I am not going to try to pronounce that any better than that. Research published in Current Biology said these birds hold the new world record for loudest bird song, which can reach 125 decibels. Guys, that is as loud as a jet engine.
Whoa.
120 decibels. Yeah, 120 decibels. Whoa. Does permanent hearing damage.
Ouch.
And the funny thing about this mating call is that it turns its head to the bird sitting close to it and yells. Let's get it on. Yeah, like that's like your wife turning to you and screaming in your ear. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is slightly obnoxious. It's a cool noise. It's definitely like a science fiction-y noise almost, but that's an animal making that noise, the bellbird. Nice. And this bird is from the Amazon, like I said.
I can get one at Amazon?
Yeah. Cool. Hell yeah, of course you can. And so just by coincidence, the person who sent this in, Julia Bell, her last name is Bell.
Oh.
And there you have it. That's the bellbird. It's loud, Steve. That's very loud.
That is loud. And decibels, we should point out, is a logarithmic scale, right? So
yeah, it's not like it's like when you get to 120, it's like you know, like earthquakes. You know, like you get up to like 120 and it's so much louder than 70. It'll literally blow your mind. You know, like it just gets ridiculously loud. So we have a new noisy this week. This was sent in by a listener named Alan Wells. And Alan said that I can't read this because this is Alan telling me what the noisy is this week. I almost blew it.
Uh-oh.
I will have to play you what he sent in. And here it is.
That's cool.
Hey. That is cool.
All right, guys. So, you know, R2-D2 on LSD. What do you think?
Yeah, it definitely has that kind of electronic sound to it.
It also reminded me of the owl from the original Clash of the Titans movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Like Bebo? Oh, yeah. Was it Bebo or something?
Bebo, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree, Ed. You know what's funny? When you think of sounds like this, there are sounds that get generated and become sounds that we know and understand, like the internet dial-up sound, right? You know, all the different versions of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that wasn't like a sound that someone sat down and constructed. It's reality. It's you know, the things that are happening when the protocols get fired. But there are also sounds and things that we encounter that have sounds to them, or soundscapes, even like the way that a room could sound, that are constructed, that are totally deliberate. And I bet you anything that the sound, this week's noisy sound was not a constructed sound. I bet you it was a happenstance sound. You know, it just happens to be what the electrical output sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
without a human shaping it, if, in other words. You know what I mean?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there it is. I know what I said didn't help you guess it, but I just wanted to make my preliminary guess for next week after I do some research. So anyway, if you heard an awesome noisy, guys, or you want to email me and say hi or say belated happy Halloween to Bob through me, you can do that by emailing me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
So, Jay, before we move on to a couple of email, we should point out that we're basically sold out for the LA extravaganza.
Wow.
By the time you hear this, there's like one or two tickets left. If you It'd probably be gone by the time this show gets out.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, rush. If you're hearing this early, just rush. You may get that last ticket. So unfortunately, the private show and the extravaganza for Los Angeles on November 23rd. So unless there's a cancellation, you can always hold out for a cancellation. Those two shows are sold out. So we're really happy to have sold out our first extravaganza 2.0. We're really excited about it. But don't worry, there's three more on the schedule.
Yeah.
Right.
There's and more to come. Yep.
Pittsburgh, January 31st, Philadelphia, February 1st, and Brooklyn, February 2nd. So go to our website, check those dates out. There's still plenty of seats left for those shows because they're a couple of months away. And then there will be more added to the schedule as well, assuming that this all works out. I mean, I'm assuming that if we don't sell enough tickets, our company will just drop us. But
yeah, right. But so far, things are going great. You know, they told us that sales are doing very good, and that it's good when you see an aggressive rush to the door. It's always awesome. But the cool thing, Evan and Bob, you don't know about this. I did have a chance to talk to Steve though, but I finalized all of our new swag.
Ooh, yep.
Ooh.
It was. Months of work. It takes months to develop a line of swag.
It does.
This is our most extensive and well thought out collection of swag that I've ever done. You know, I hired two artists, and I'm also being consulted by a professional swag distribution company. So we're going to have some really good swag at the extravaganza, and we're also going to have some good new SGU swag, some things that we've never had before that I'm really excited about. And I don't mind saying it right now. We developed a line of lapel pins that were highly requested and recommended by a lot of people that are like, why in the hell aren't you selling like fun, sciencey, SGU related lapel pins? So we have them, and the artist that helped me did a great job. We had a lot of fun working together, and I'm proud to say that, we've got that bunch of t-shirts, a hoodie, a knit cap, a couple of cool things. The extravaganza.
RJ, my favorite swag item, that new swag item that we have?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I don't even mention Steve's swag picks. These are all my swag picks. Steve got fantastic, I dare say an illuminating pen.
I know.
It has a flashlight on it.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a pen with a pen light, on the clicker part on the top. It's really good. Now with LED lights, man, you could put a great light anywhere. But we had our friend who does a lot of our images, Kernan.
Kernan Coleman, yeah.
Made a logo version for the pen. That's awesome. When you see it on the pen, it just fits so well. There's a rocket and everything. It's cool. This is I think just the execution of this particular swag item is my favorite of anything that we've done. But we also have the luggage handles, and we're experimenting with something new that we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes.
Do you not want to say what it is?
Yes, it's a coin. It's an SGU challenge coin, which we Jay and I designed together, again, also with Kernan. Very pretty, very nice. We haven't gotten them physically yet, so I'm dying to see what they're going to look like. So we're gonna road test those in Australia and New Zealand, see how it goes. And if they sell well, there may be other versions, maybe limited editions and things like that coming out. That's kind of a fun thing to do, to play with. I had a good time with that one.
Yeah, I feel like there's something fun here that we haven't tapped into yet. Like they're like, we could have coins that go with events, and maybe they can even be used to do something. I don't know. I want to think more about it. But I do like, the coin. I like things that have that weight. I don't know what you would call it. Like they have like
they're
metal. Have a gravitas
heft.
Yeah, they have a heft that gives them like a real bend in reality that feels good in your hand. I always liked like big coins and stuff. So when Steve brought this up, I usually don't like Steve's swag ideas and. I know. It's like, okay. Steve came up with the pens. I'm like, nobody wants a pen. We sold out. Steve came up with the luggage handles. I'm like, Steve, nobody wants a luggage. They sold out. And then, now I've got them on my luggage. I love them because they're stupid colors and you recognize your suitcase from like a half a mile away in the airport.
They're great.
And this is something that you would never buy for yourself. You'd never go to Amazon, but I'm going to get a luggage handle tie.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
But when you're at the con and you're like, oh, all right, and I gave some away and blah, blah, blah. And I ended up having people come back like that, got them at TAM, telling me that they still have them and they love it because they can see their luggage in the, in the airport.
Yeah, they're brightly colored.
It is perfect for that. Perfect.
And a comfortable grip.
So nice the coin falls into this category where I'm like, the coin, Steve? I'm like, what? But,
All right, we'll see.
I like a good t-shirt. We designed a 70s rock and roll style t-shirt for the extravaganza, and I'm telling you, it's awesome. I cannot wait to grab one when we're at the event, because that's when I'm going to see them in the, in the flesh for the first time.
I'd like to put forth a suggestion for the coin.
Okay.
Yes. I would like to invite our SGU listeners who actually get this coin to participate in a 100 flip challenge. Flip that coin 100 times, record which side it landed on each time, and then send your results in to us at the SGU. We will tabulate all the results we get from everyone doing their 100 flips,
and let you know what the statistical results are in lots of different ways.
Who's going to do the work?
Oh, Joe's statistician.
That was just Evan volunteering, Jay, didn't
you? Oh, okay, okay. Because every time, because Evan, you know, I'm so busy. Like I'm so busy.
You propose that's the rule of volunteering. If you propose a good idea, you're doing it. Like you're executing the idea or shut up.
Said it, so I guess I'm responsible for it now.
That's right. All right, I do want to leave time for a couple of email questions.
Yes.
The first one comes from Dan from Japan. Dan from Japan. And Dan from Japan writes, love your show, member for several years, not sure if you have followed Joy Scientific, that's J-O-I Scientific, and their claim for a unique hydrogen from seawater technology. Just wanted to let you know that I was approached indirectly to help them with business matters several years ago, and on looking into it, I discovered every single red flag I had learned from the SGU. Seriously, all the red flags, even including investment by famous rich people. With the voice of SGU whispering in my ear, I called BS and said there was zero chance of Joy Scientific somehow reinventing physics and delivering the hydrogen economy perfectly formed. 2 years and many millions of dollars later, they have admitted that their claim of 200% efficiency was based on faulty measurement. So they are now seeking additional funding for research centered around their improved understanding of the technology.
Another red flag. Okay.
So the scam goes on. I would love to hear your take on Joy Scientific if you've ever looked for a textbook cases of pseudoscience in the critical field of energy and resources. Thanks and regards. So yeah, I can't resist free energy scams. I took a look at Joy Scientific and it is everything that Dan promised. I think they've probably gotten a little bit more subtle over the years, but still you're reading through it. And first of all, they're remarkably vague on what they're actually doing and how it's all going to work. So they basically describe the whole basic concept of splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen and then burning it back again to get the energy out of it, right? It's like, okay, duh, that's hydrogen. Yeah, we get that. But they go on and on about how it's an abundant, you know, natural resource of sustainable energy, right? So here's right from their website. Hydrogen 2.0 has the potential to usher in a new hydrogen era through the applicability of hydrogen as a practical, abundant, and sustainable energy source. Right out of the gate, hydrogen is not an energy source. It's not a source of energy. It is a storage medium. It is a battery. That's it, right? Unless you're somehow mining free hydrogen, of which there is none on the Earth. So if you're in orbit around Jupiter and sucking away the hydrogen, yes, you can use that as an energy source. But if you're here on Earth, hydrogen is not an energy source. So they're confusing their message right there.
Great. Right off the bat.
Yeah. They said water's plentiful. Yeah, we know water is plentiful. Who cares?
Thank you.
It offers a green life cycle based on readily available, low cost, and recycled materials. All right. A green life cycle completely depends on what energy you're using to separate the hydrogen from the water in the first place. So again, it's like this, any battery is a green energy cycle if you're using green energy. So it's irrelevant. So they're claiming to have a better extraction method. Okay, talk about that. If that's what your innovation that you, but they don't talk about it at all. Now maybe they do somewhere deep in their, you know, in their material that I haven't penetrated yet. But all I really want to know, like the one piece of information I want to know is nowhere on their website that I've seen so far. And that is, what's the round trip efficiency of your method? Tell me that. That's it. Because that's the only value in all of this. But they talk about everything else. Here's the thing that really makes no sense. I'm quoting from the website again. It introduces a novel way to store the hydrogen in water at room temperature and ambient pressure before the hydrogen is extracted. The hydrogen is converted into a gas on demand where and when it is needed, on board or on site, making it a fully distributed versus the current centralized one. So they're saying is you basically just are storing and distributing water. And then you burn that water as fuel with their magical process. Okay. If you're converting the water on site into the hydrogen that you're then going to burn, then you need an energy source on site.
Yeah, what's in order, doing that work?
Right? Yeah. So, and they say possible applications include internal combustion engines, fuel cells. Do tell. How are you going to be, are you going to put water in a tank of a car and run the car off that water? No, you're not, unless you have a completely separate source of energy, in which case the hydrogen is just a loss of energy efficiency.
Oh my gosh, how many times have we seen this?
I know.
This is the same old rehashed perpetual motion like machine.
But it keeps making people money, Ev. That's why it keeps happening.
I understand why they do it.
Because it's on site. He's trying to make that into a virtue. It actually makes it worthless because whatever energy you're using to split the hydrogen at the point of use, you could just use for whatever the thing is, right? Use the energy to drive the car, not to make water into hydrogen, then hydrogen to drive the car.
Remember when we were talking about Dennis Lee way back when?
Yeah.
And so what's the energy source? He's like using gasoline or something. He's using some, you know, but he never tells you about it, what the extra energy source is. It's total. Oh, this reminds me so much of that.
So at one point, you know, they're comparing their process to other processes. And they say, you don't want to use a process, you know, where you have to put more energy into it than you get out. You know, we change all that. I'm like, really? Mm-hmm. How? By changing the second law of thermodynamics?
There you go.
They literally say we're not beholden to the second law of thermodynamics. It's like you have to put more energy into it than you get out. That's the law.
There's no way around that. There's no way around that.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So, Dan, you are correct. That's a good catch. This is all smoke and mirrors. It's just repackaging again this whole idea of splitting water and then burning it again without really putting it into context. Now, if he were saying this is grid storage because we've made the round-trip efficiency of using hydrogen as grid storage more efficient. Great. Tell us about that. Everything else, everything I'm reading on the website is basically bullshit. It's just all the smoke and mirrors. And sometimes just making blatant pseudoscientific statements, like hydrogen's an energy source. And what, do you want to put more energy in than you get out of it? Like a sucker?
Right? That's so yesterday.
Right. Okay, one more. This one's quick. This one comes from Trevor, and Trevor writes, "Hi, I've seen a lot of online chat about an imminent solar minimum, possibly even a grand solar minimum. Tied to this, lots of wild predictions of famine. I found it surprisingly hard to find a decent source on this topic. NASA seems quite calm about it, though. It seems to have all the hallmarks of ill-informed fear-mongering, but wondered if it's something you guys might cover at some point." What do you think, Bob? Are we going to all die because of the upcoming solar minimum?
No. I think we're pretty safe there, Steve. I'm not too worried about it.
So what is the solar minimum? Tell us about that a little bit.
A solar minimum is a period in the cycle of the sun where the number of sunspots reaches its minimum in that cycle. And we have had, though, some long-lasting and really, really low minimums, you know, where there's like not one speck on the face of the sun, and the cycle lasted a little bit longer. But are we in danger? I mean, yeah, it's really scary to contemplate that the sun goes through a phase where it's actually killed, you know, it's inimical to life on Earth. But, there's a long history of life on the Earth without the sun going wacky and knocking it out. Sure, there's been plenty of extinctions, but they've never been caused by the sun. So I'm not too concerned about the solar minimum. Are you? Is there anything new that's been released?
No, I read, you know, NASA's site about it. I read some, you know, whatever was published about it. So yeah, it does affect the climate. It actually could make things a little bit cooler, but it's been studied, and it's not going to mitigate, you know, climate change. But there could be, again, so when we're looking at climate change, we're looking at multiple overlapping trends at once, resulting in a net effect. And solar forcing, including the solar minimum, is one of those background, you know, oscillations in the climate that you have to factor in, you know, when you're looking at what's responsible for recent changes, you know, in average temperatures. So solar forcing has been ruled out as a cause of the increase in global temperatures over the last 50 years.
And it was ruled out early, right? It was one of those things that you got to deal with solar forcing really early in this process of, I was on the short climate change. Right, yeah, it was on the short list. And people today actually saying, oh, it's just variability because of the sun. It's just like,
ooh,
wow.
Scientists never thought about that, except they did immediately, like right after, as soon as it became a question. Like, well, let's check out solar forcing. Let's see what effect is that having. I mean, they didn't even hypothesize human forcing until after they ruled out solar forcing. That was kind of, you know, God, we've done all the usual stuff, and we're left with this something else causing forcing the temperatures to get warmer. They didn't even say that until after they had already ruled out solar forcing by definition. But anyway.
And that's part of science where you got a checklist of all the stuff, you know, all the low-hanging fruit. Well, it's probably one of these 10 things. You got to check them off. Once they're checked off, then you can start talking about the things that are, you know, may seem much less likely. I mean, that's how it works, kids.
So anyway, but there may be a temporary cooling trend which would, you know, soften the warming trend for a bit, but it's not going to affect the long-term trend, right? It's just going to...
Right. This is not a solution.
So basically, the rate of warming will slow a little bit and then accelerate, you know, as we shift into a solar maximum. Mm-hmm. It's just that those two curves are superimposed, but it's not affecting the human forcing curve. Does that make sense? But anyway, yeah, this is nothing to worry about. The other thing that it may be a problem for satellites, NASA is all about the satellites. It's like during a solar minimum, so the magnetic field of the sun is a little bit decreased, so we're a little bit less protected from cosmic rays, but also the atmosphere is puffed up a little bit less during a solar minimum, and therefore there's less drag on satellites, which means that there's more accumulation of space junk. So NASA's worried about the effect of the solar minimum on the accumulation of space junk. But they make no mention of anything like famine. You know, it's not going to affect our agriculture. But thanks for asking the question, Trevor. All right, guys, it's time to move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And we have a theme this week. I think it's a theme I've used before, but it's timely. It's not Halloween. It's daylight savings time. Guys, ready to judge three facts about daylight savings time?
I need an extra hour, but yeah, all right.
Because Daylight savings time ends this weekend. We fall back. We go back to Eastern Standard Time for us on the East Coast. Standard time.
I like Standard Time.
I like. They should keep daylight savings time year round. Just make that's the time. It's just the Standard Time. It gets too dark too early in the evening.
You think it's too dark? Oh, too in the evening. Yeah, yeah. In the morning it's dark right now. But
yeah.
Once we go back,
I hate driving home in the dark.
That's okay, because I'm asleep then.
All right. I mean, if you wake up to the dark, like the sun's coming. But if you get home from work and it's dark, it's like you feel like a troll.
Yeah, true.
Okay.
True.
Here we go. Item number one. The first use of daylight savings time was in Ontario, Canada in 1908. Item number two. Researchers estimate that an extra 600 people die each year in the U.S. due to car crashes because of the switch to DST. Item number three, studies looking at energy cost of DST show it is basically a wash with slight advantages or disadvantages depending on region. Bob, go first.
Okay. Let's see. So Canada, 1908, did it first. I mean, okay. I mean, that's got nothing to contribute about that. Let's see. Extra 600 people die each year. 600 because of car crashes. So I'm trying to think why. I mean, it's dark. You put on your headlights. What's the problem?
So just to clarify, this includes switching twice a year, both switches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not sure about that one. So let's look at the third one here. Energy costs. Huh. Wow. I mean, none of these are just really leaping out at me. I'm just going to have to flip a coin here. Which one is causing a gut reaction? 600 people dying each year. Why does that sound familiar? Jay, why does that sound familiar to me?
600.
The cost. I'm going to say the cost. Something about the cost is rubbing me the wrong way. I think one has a clear advantage. I don't know. I'll go with the cost. Fiction.
Maybe. All right, Jay.
The cost. Okay, so I'm going to start with the third one because that's the one I spent the least time thinking about. Studies looking at energy cost of DST show it is basically a wash with slight advantages or disadvantages depending on region. I mean, that one makes a lot of sense. You know, because it makes perfect sense when you think of something that wasn't thoroughly researched and is now just like, would you say it's not politically driven, but it's just kind of like, we're too lazy to fix it, even though it should be, we should drop it.
I think it's laziness driven, yeah.
Yeah. Researchers estimate that an extra 600 people die each year in the U.S. due to car crashes. I don't know. It seems like, you know, it's oddly a very low number or a very high number, depending on which way I flip it in my brain. That's a lot of people to die. I don't know how they're really determining that. You know, if they interview every family, like, you know, Al went to bed really late last night. I guess daylight savings killed my husband. I don't know. You know, like, let me just get to this first one. Our first one used daylight savings time was on. I definitely think that the first time that it was used was in 19. I don't know about where, but definitely around that year is when I would say it started. So it's between the Al dying in his car and this last one here, which I already talked about, which I kind of believe. So I'll just say that the second one, the 600, is the fake because I don't think that I don't think hardly anybody dies from daylight savings. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay, and Evan,
I'll agree with Jay. I think the extra 600 people dying each year is going to be the fiction. Mine is based on simple mathematics, and it might be overly simplistic. You got my last recollection of the statistics are you have about 40,000 casualties over the course of a year, 365 days a year. That's a little over 100 a day on average. So what you're saying is that on these 2 days in particular, as a result of these 2 days, you're adding an additional essentially 300 for each of the daylight saving shifts. And I just don't think statistically that works out. I think mathematically it's off. So that's why I think that one is the fiction.
Okay. So you guys all agree on the first one. So we'll start there. The first use of daylight savings time was in Ontario, Canada in 1908. You all think this one is science.
Oh, you betcha.
This one is science.
I knew it.
Science, eh?
Did you know it, Noah, Bob, or you just guessed?
I just wanted to say I know it because I won't be able to say it again for the rest of the night.
Probably. this could have been tricky because the common belief is that it was innovated in Germany, and Germany was the first. The German Empire was the first state to introduce daylight savings time in 1916.
Yeah, I seem to recall something like that somewhere in the fold of my brain.
But on July 1st, 1908, the residents of Port Arthur, Ontario, today's Thunder Bay, were the first ones to institute daylight savings time.
Oh, well, now we know who to blame.
Yeah, then spread to the German Empire, and then the rest is history. There's lots of myths about where it came from otherwise. So there were a couple of people who proposed it previously. One of whom was not Benjamin Franklin. He's often credited with being the first to propose daylight savings time, but he actually wrote a letter suggesting that Parisians could economize their candle usage, not by changing the clocks, but by getting people out of bed earlier in the morning. So it didn't have to do with the clocks, and it was a joke. It was completely meant as a satire, as a joke. So it's not Ben Franklin. But ancient, again, what they know from time, right? I mean, like ancient Romans, their water clocks, they would use different scales for different times of the year so that basically you were waking up with the same time with the sun. You know what I mean? They basically were setting their clocks to the sun anyway. So they were adjusting clocks to the seasons, but not anything that would be that you could call daylight savings time. All right, I guess we'll take these in order. Let's go to number two. Researchers estimate that an extra 600 people die each year in the U.S. due to car crashes because of the switch to daylight savings time. Evan and Jay think this one is the fiction. Bob thinks this one is science. Evan has done some quick back-of-the-envelope calculations in his head, and he thinks that that's just too many extra people to be dying on those days. Mm-hmm. And this one is The fiction. Good job, guys. Okay. Yeah, Evan, those calculations were accurate, and that's good reasoning. I think that was perfectly solid reasoning. That would be a pretty dramatic increase if you're going from 100 people dying to 300, but actually it would be a lot worse because there are extra deaths, but it's only the extra deaths are only in the springing forward because you lose an hour's sleep. So there's
interesting. There's
an increase in sleep Makes deprivation. Sense. So there's more sleepy drivers and more accidents. And Jay, they didn't interview people. This is just all statistics. There's a little bump in the statistics. There's an excess residue of extra car crashes on the day that we have to spring forward. But researchers calculated that resulted in extra 30 deaths over 10 years. So you're talking three a year. So this was order 200 times that many. So it's very, very, very small. And there's actually fewer deaths in the fall because people get more sleep. However, the bigger risk from daylight savings time is from heart attacks. There's more people it's still not huge, but there's more people, extra deaths from heart attacks than car crashes associated with daylight savings time. Again, that springing forward and losing sleep and everything is just bad. So, but the numbers are relatively low, but still, there's no reason for it. Just get rid of it. Just get rid of daylight savings time. Number three, studies looking at energy cost of daylight savings time show it is basically a wash with slight advantages or disadvantages depending on region. That one is science. The advantage is that it does decrease the use of light, of energy for light. The disadvantage is that it increases the use of energy for heating. Because people are up later in colder months, and so they use more heating. And so those balance each other out overall, but in some places there may be a little bit of a disadvantage for the heating, and others might have a little bit of an advantage for the lighting. You know, so it varies from region to region, but the whole thing is basically a wash. So that's not a reason for daylight savings time. Can't justify saying, oh, it saves energy. It actually doesn't. Basically neutral.
I knew it.
All right. Well, good job, guys. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Time and again, science has shown that methodological naturalism can push back ignorance, finding increasingly detailed and informative answers to mysteries that once seemed impenetrable. The nature of light, the causes of disease, how the brain works. Evolution is doing the same with the riddle of how the living world took shape. Creationism, by any name, adds nothing of intellectual value to the effort. And that was written by our friend John Rennie back in 2002 in an article that I still refer to occasionally. It's called 15 Answers to Creationist Nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, it's a good article. It's a good science.
John Rennie, I miss that mother.
I know. Yeah. I haven't seen him in a long time.
We love you, John.
Yeah, it's a good quote. Cuts right to the point, you know, that, yeah, methodological naturalism actually works. It gives us answers. It gives us better answers to these questions. And when you consider things like creationism, which is essentially saying magic, it adds nothing. It gives us nothing of intellectual value. That's a very apt way of putting it. It accomplishes nothing. It's just saying, hey, it's magic. And I do like to refer to this as the meta experiment of science itself, right? Of methodological naturalism. Let's try this for a while, see how it works out. Well, it turns out it's working out fabulously. It works great. This whole you know, science thing is like really, really giving us results. Let's keep doing that. You know, it's working. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure.
You got it, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.